Ladies and gentlemen, your conference call is about to begin. Here is your moderator, Raymond Ibrahim.
Thank you for joining us today to another Middle East Forum conference call. Our guest today is Mr. Harris Rafiq, who is the co-founder of the Sufi Muslim Council in the UK and longtime counter-extremism advisor to the British government. Today he will discuss the efficacy, or lack thereof, of terrorist rehabilitation programs. He will be speaking for roughly 10 minutes and then taking questions for the remainder of the time. Please begin, Mr. Rafiq.
Thank you, Raymond. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you to the Middle East Forum for inviting me to present today. Before I start the presentation, I just want to touch on a personal story and how I actually got involved in this field. Like many other people of my generation living in England, I was born here in 1965 and got on with my life as an average Muslim person, a British Muslim person who was developed a very, the Islam that I believed in was a personal relationship between myself and God. And I got on with my life and work, etc. Because the average son of an immigrant that came in this country, certainly the immigrants when they migrated in the 60s, 70s and 80s, really were economic social migrants. And work and getting on with things was really the key element of how we were brought up. But about 6 years ago, my youngest child, my daughter, came home one day and said, "Daddy, I don't want to be a Muslim." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because Muslims are always angry, they're always killing people, and they're always burning Guy Fawkes's." And I thought, well, I like a good bonfire. Show me where you're getting this thinking from. And she flicks over onto television, and there were some guys who happened to be Muslim. They were very angry. They looked as if they were going to kill somebody, and they were burning effigies of George Bush and Tony Blair. And this started a real process of introspection for me, because here was a child who was 6 years old. She didn't really know anything about politics. She didn't understand theology. She didn't understand ideology. She just knew from the messages she was getting from other children, other Muslims around the community, that Islam is about hate. And she didn't want to be angry. And if she was thinking this, the questions that went through my mind included, what must other Muslim youngsters be thinking? And also, just as importantly for me, what must my non-Muslim friends, neighbors, associates be thinking about Muslims? And this started a real introspection and research into the faith that I called my own, Islam. And I discovered after about a year's worth of research that really I'd come full circle, and the Islam that my parents taught me, which wasn't being taught now, certainly in the UK and around the world, was one that I felt most comfortable with, one that was not about being separate from anybody else, one that when preached, it was preached and taught as a spiritual relationship between me and God, and there was no dichotomy between being Pakistani and Muslim, being British and Muslim, and really not hating anybody. And along the way, I now work for an organization called Sentry, which really focuses on looking at how Islamists are radicalized and looking at the stages of radicalization. And we've had some success over the years in deprogramming individuals as well, and that's really what I want to talk about now. In order to really understand how to detox or deprogram somebody who's gone down this radicalization process, we really need to understand how and why they've gone there, the psychological motivators, the religious, the theological, the ideological motivators, both of the radicalizers and also what individuals are going through as well. A typical scenario for Muslims growing up in certainly the UK and maybe in the US as well to some extent, and nothing's changed from when I was younger. Most Muslims go to mosque after school for a couple of hours every day, and we learn only two things at the mosque. One is how to incorrectly pronounce the Quran, and secondly, how to perform our daily obligations, and that's it. And when we then grow older and we want to then explore our faith, learn more about our faith, if somebody then comes along and misquotes and preys on fears and insecurities that we may have, there is no resilience. And that's one of the key starting points from a very young age that help people go down this process. There are a number of Islamist strategic tactics, and then there are individual tactics. What I want to focus now is on the individual rather than the strategic tactics used by organizations. There really isn't a distinct formula as to how someone would become radicalized and then go on to be a terrorist. But there seem to be four common stages and then many sub-stages in between that as well. The first one really is that some form of perceived vulnerability is created. This could be self-produced or generated by others, and really focuses on some form of personal crisis. Now, that could be something very, very simple like racism or perceived racism, not being able to get a job. That could be, as in the case of the leader of the 7/7 bomber, Sadiq Khan, not wanting to have an arranged marriage, which is actually cultural. And then looking for answers, because Sadiq Khan himself was going out with somebody, had a girlfriend, a fiancé for a number of years, somebody who he wanted to marry. His father wanted him to marry his cousin, which was a cultural practice back home in Pakistan, and I say that in inverted commas. And he was looking for answers. How can he seek a solution to his answers through the faith? And obviously he was then approached by others who would radicalize him. So here was the first stage, really, is to have some form of crisis and then look for answers. The second stage really, which is quite common, is exposure to a type of lens, a lens really through which the answers are skewed towards a particular viewpoint. And I'll overstate the case, the example, just to make a point. The answer to the fact that somebody may not be able to get a job is that they may be seeing racism, or Muslims are being picked on and not really getting the chances that they should have, and therefore they should join with other Muslims and really work on setting a caliphate system or creating a them and us scenario. And the answer then is to work towards this system, and only when we have a caliph will we have a fair system where everybody will be equal. So this lens is then created. A them and us part of that is very, very common, and it's very, very important. Theology is used to justify this them and us situation. Radicalization at this stage can actually take a very, very quick pace. The third phase really is that once they become part of this group, exposure then really, they're then exposed to people who would recruit them towards furthering particular aspects within a cause. Now, for example, the Detroit bomber, which we're I'm just compiling and just completing a report at the moment in how the Detroit bomber, Umar Farooq Abdulmuttalib, was radicalized, and it's for the EU Counterterrorism Department. The evidence suggests, like many other cases, that he was radicalized here in the UK. And he was picked, and he became president of the University Islamic Society, amongst other things, and invited known extremist scholars to come and participants to come and speak. So he was selected. So the third stage really is to select people to actually further the cause, and that could be just building capacity, or it could be a number of things. And the fourth stage really is actually internalizing values and support for violence. This is when somebody actually decides that I am going to support, either fundraise, speak on behalf of and recruit, or actually strap a bomb on to myself and go and kill innocent people. These are quite common phases that certainly the majority of people who've been radicalized go through. Another point I just want to make at this stage is that I've spoken to quite a few friends from the US, and I've often heard in the past arguments that, oh, our Muslims are much better than your Muslims across the pond, because our Muslims are much better integrated, their social standing is a lot better, they're much more middle class, and they're a lot more patriotic. Well, one of the things that we've been working on, and there will be a report that's coming out by a think tank that I'm actually working with at the moment, is that a study proves that certainly the overwhelming majority of jihadists that have been either found guilty or charged with terrorism have been middle class, have at some stage been integrated into the community, and also most of them have had some form of higher education. And I get quite disheartened when people try to argue that social factors such as poverty and non-integration and racism, etc., are the root causes of extremism. They're not, it's not the root cause. That's one of the perceived personal crisis that people will pick on, recruiters will pick on, to actually move people towards their cause. So deprogramming. How do we deprogram, or how have we had some success in deprogramming people who've been Islamist or jihadist, certainly in the UK and around other parts as well. Well, the first thing really that we've done is by using sessions of mentoring, halakas, which are gatherings, social interaction, exposing individuals and groups, is to deconstruct this lens that's been created, a lens which is a combination of theology and ideology, but focusing on the ISIS model, which is the ideological, social, emotional, and spiritual. If we look at the ideological aspects, it's around developing and propagating counter-ideological and theological narratives, and happy to talk about that a little bit more if somebody has a question around that, using moderate Sharia-based rationale, which is really still mainstream position on many things, using aspects like, for example, Britain and other countries are not Darul Islam, not Darul Harb, they're Darul Islam, and then explaining why they are. Promoting critical thinking. We've had some great success with, I remember a guy that I worked with personally, worked on, who left, who was actually at one stage on quite senior within Hizb ut-Tahrir here in the UK. He was on the National Executive Committee. And one of the key aspects of his deprogramming was to promote this critical thinking by giving him alternatives to actually ask questions of himself and within the organizations. And again, returning to traditional Islamic values of separation between faith and politics. Then there's the social aspects, and that's really developing ways where people can air grievances, sometimes political, sometimes others, by using methods which already are there in a peaceful manner, removing the concept of loyalty and enmity for the sake of God, for the sake of Allah, and really taking away the them and us situations, engaging and facilitating in intercultural activities rather than interfaith, because sometimes interfaith can be where people of good intention sit around a table and say how wonderful we all are, and then nothing really happens. It's by actually getting people to work with people of other faiths and looking at then refocusing the energies of these people that have been deprogrammed back into doing something positive in the community. An example of that is that we ran a magazine for about a year and a half, when we had people who were developed enough within their deprogramming so that they could actually contribute articles within this magazine. And one of the key rules that we had is that it must be non-political and there must be no them and us scenarios and no hatred. And that ran for about a year and a half as well. Then if we look at the emotional, looking at interventions for vulnerable individuals and institutions, there's a program that we have here in the UK that's run by certain authorities and agencies called Channel, where they refer individuals throughout the various different stages of the radicalization process to experts that we have, who really are from the different sectarian beliefs, and that's really there so that we can actually give credibility and legitimacy to the people that they're deprogramming, removing some of the myths that they have, and dealing with angry individuals in volatile situations, and also giving them the ability to belong to a group which is not part of this angry, political motivated Islamist agenda. And finally, the spiritual aspects. When radicalizing youngsters, recruiters tend to remove the spiritual aspects of being a better human being, developing that inner moral excellence. And then there's a number of training techniques that we have and a number of areas that we actually get them involved in doing dhikr, which is reciting God's names, and a number of other areas where we reuse traditional practices that Muslims have used for centuries, where they're really focusing on themselves. And by focusing on themselves and working outwards, becoming a better human being and behaving in a more positive and contributing manner. Finally, I just want to say, before we move on to the Q&A, that this is an area that we've had some success in, and by no means is it possible to de-radicalize or detox or deprogram every single person that goes down the jihadist line. But I think it's important that when we do undertake these programs, and when we have undertaken these programs, that we actually take out the aspect that Islam itself is not compatible with a Western society or Western liberal values, because the very fact that the migrants that came over and have been living in Europe and the West for decades have been able to do that, means that actually Islam, when we go back to the values that I've just talked about, really is something that can add and contribute to help people play positive contributing roles in society. Thank you, Raymond.
Thank you very much for that, Harris. That was very informative, and it's good to know that it actually works with some people. I'd like to actually take a question regarding something that you said. You briefly made mention of the concept of how some of the more radical Islamists embrace the notion of loyalty and enmity, which of course is an Arabic, or has the Arabic name of wala wa bara in Islam.
Absolutely.
And is used, and it's, and I've always seen that as one of the most hurdles to get over to make radical Islamists be able to live at peace with their quote unquote infidel neighbors. And so I'd like to hear some more on how to try to get, by, especially when they, and as I'm sure they do, invoke certain Quranic verses that make it very clear, for instance, do not befriend Christians and Jews, et cetera, et cetera. So I'd like to hear some of what you think about that.
Sure. In terms of the concept that you mentioned, at the very core of that concept is that anybody essentially who is not practicing the faith the way that they practice or the way that they perceive is the right way is, and that includes other Muslims as well, is to either be hated. I mean, their view is that you should fight them. If you can't hate them by hand, then you actually take the lower level of hatred, which is to speak against them, you know, hate them by mouth, and then if you can't do that, hate them certainly at the lower level, which is in your heart. Now, I believe that hating in the heart, hatred in the heart can be a lot more dangerous than certainly speaking to somebody, because at least if you're speaking to somebody about a disagreement that you have, you can actually engage in some debate. The way that we've overcome that, and you're absolutely right, it is at the core of the Salafi Wahhabi theology that actually has really infiltrated many of the other mainstream versions of Islam as well, in actually gaining some form of loyalty and belonging to a group and hating everybody else. So what we've done is we've dissected certain hadith, we've certainly dissected certain passages from the Quran, and I'll give you an example of one. There's a hadith that's actually used quite a lot, or misused quite a lot, to promote anti-Semitism, and that the hadith talks about there'll be a fight against Jews, and every rock and every stone will cry out that there is a Jew hiding behind me, and they'll be exposed, and you can kill them. And that's one that's quite commonly used. I beg your pardon?
And a special tree called the Gandak tree.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, one of the ways that we've done is actually taken that hadith into context and looked at the wider collection of hadith and what it's referring to. And one of the things, what it's actually referring to is what we call apocalyptic, certainly the end days, and when the Messiah will return and there'll be a fight and a struggle. And we actually take the other aspects and the other hadiths as well and actually highlight to them that when the Messiah comes and this then will be discussed and this fight will happen, there'll be Muslims that will reject the Messiah, as well as Christians, as well as Jews, and as well as people of no faith as well. And let's look at the other hadith that talk about, and the other sayings and traditional views that talk about, well, the first battle will be with Muslims who reject the Messiah, and 70,000 Muslim ulama will be killed. Then there'll be other fights with Christians, then there'll be other fights with Jews, and there'll be other fights with other people. And it won't be because they are Muslim, Christian, or Jewish, or anything else. It'll be because they reject the Messiah, and it will be a battle between good and evil. And it's just taking arguments like that and taking them into wider context and contextualizing them and using traditional views and values and even scholars to actually highlight that this is actually what it's all about.
Ladies and gentlemen, to join the question and answer session queue, just press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I'll announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Please remember that if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. And our first question comes from the line of Mr. Lawrence Gould. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yes. A two-part question. Why don't imams and mullahs criticize jihadist training? And the second thing, how can leaders of Muslim nations, especially Saudi Arabia, be convinced not to support jihadism, terrorists, who kill and maim many more Muslims than Israelis and other Westerners?
Absolutely. A great question. Thank you very much for that question. Well, I think that first and foremost, the first question about the imams not criticizing jihadist training, I think there are some. In the U.S., we have a great example. We have Sheikh Hisham Kabbani there, certainly, who has tried to criticize jihadists and their beliefs and training, etc. One of the key reasons why less and less imams are actually coming out and criticizing, although it is changing now, is that there is this fear, and it's a genuine fear and a genuine concern of being bullied, of being criticized, and in some cases being attacked. I remember certainly in 2006 in the UK, by the grace of God, I was one of the first people that actually stuck my head above the parapet and actually started admitting that there is a problem here in the UK and that we need to do something about it. And now there are many more. And I remember at the time there was an awful lot of bullying that took place, and that bullying doesn't necessarily always have to be physical. That's on the internet. It could be in magazines. It could be in the mosques. And imams certainly are afraid. Secondly, the imams themselves that we produce, certainly in the West, and even sometimes in the Muslim countries, well, when I say Muslim countries, countries like Pakistan as well, certainly they're not of the quality and standard whereby they are able to actually dissect these arguments and actually understand them for themselves as well. Sometimes they feel, well, that's something that we don't really know a lot about or we don't know enough about. We're actually going to stay away from that and focus on something else. And then, of course, you've got the third part. The third part of the answer is that more and more mosques that we see now, certainly in the US, the UK, and around the world, are being funded by extremist by countries and individuals from extremist backgrounds who actually believe in this jihad qital or believe in this theological aspect of jihad. And there are some great articles. I know Sheikh Kabbani in the US did an article about the 14 different classifications of jihad, and the actual one where you actually take up arms is the lowest one. And there's much more and more money being pumped out around the world that actually wants to drive this agenda. With regards to the Muslim leaders around the world, and let's focus on Saudi Arabia. We probably all know the history and how Saudi Arabia came to be. There is a huge amount of control of, again, the Salafi Wahhabi theology and the merger of Wahhabism and Islamism, certainly when Hassan al-Banna's son went to Saudi Arabia, and the creation of WAMI, OIC, and a number of organizations. And again, King Abdullah looks like he might be changing things in Saudi Arabia or trying to impact some change. But again, if he changes things at too fast a pace, he may well be afraid of the impact that will have on him personally, fearing assassinations and other things. So I think the change can happen. More pressure needs to be applied on these leaders, certainly from the US, the UK, and other countries, to actually open up some form of dialogue, some form of free market of ideas, theological ideas, and promotion or support of allowing people within their own countries. Because at this moment in time, in places like Saudi Arabia, unless you particularly aspire to their beliefs and the way they practice Islam, if you differ in any way, one has the prospects of being locked up and interned.
And we'll take our next question now, but just before I bring our next caller in, I would just like to remind everyone we are running fairly close to our end time, so please phrase your question as directly and as briefly as possible. Our next question is from the line of Mr. Michael Morgenstern. Go ahead with your question, please.
Thank you for this. Can you explain how in these detox programs you can identify when somebody is legitimate and honest, and when taqiyya is presenting itself? I mean, how can you know when they have, textual basis for dissembling?
Sure. Takiyah can be a massive problem, and it has been a massive problem, the ability to try and hide what you really believe. It's one of the key, a number of key ways. One of the key ways that we've actually got people to pass this Takiyah stages, and for us to actually understand that they have actually been, what we actually do is we actually have a signposting system or a layers where we have red, amber, green, and green. And we actually monitor people and the activities and their output and move them down. Certain activities like publicly working with people who may be Jewish, working to publicly debate against other Islamists. I mean, we one of the people that went through the program who I work with quite closely now, last week, stood up in front of 150 very, very angry Islamists and debated why and how the University College Islamic Society in London has actually radicalized the Detroit bomber. So it's getting them to do very public activities, getting them to write, getting them to brief against other Islamists and expose other Islamists is a key sign that we've actually used to monitor whether they've actually gone past that Takiyah. Because one of the things that Islamists will not do, or jihadists or extremists will not do, is to expose other extremists and jihadists who they believe may be working towards a common cause.
Our final question comes from the line of Ms. Margot Einstein. Go ahead with your question, please.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Rafiq. You're a very brave man, and bless you for listening to your six-year-old daughter. According to Wafa Sultan, it's Islam itself which is the problem, and the book that she has written called The God Who Hates. Can you clear up some of that confusion in my mind?
Sure. I actually haven't read her book. I mean, if you know of any certain points that she's made, which may be... I mean, I don't believe Islam is the problem. I believe Muslims are the problem, and I believe that certainly after the... after sort of the British Empire and the Ottoman Empires, we saw other empires that tried to pop up, and in Europe we had fascism and communism, and in the Middle East we had Ba'athism and Islamism, when the Islamists were certainly quashed and some of them were interned and killed, and it's when the Islamists then moved towards went to Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabi Salafi theology merged with the Islamist ideology, that's when we actually saw, that's when it really became dangerous. The other problem we have is that most of the literature that is available now, certainly in the West, and certainly in other countries as well, has been sponsored by this theological movement and this ideological movement. As somebody, when my father died about 20 years ago, one of the things I wanted to do was to become a better Muslim for him, a more pious Muslim. So I started reading, I started picking up books. The only thing that was available to me, or the only literature in English that was available to me, was either Jamaat Islami, was either Ikhwan al-Muslimin, or hardcore Wahhabi Salafi. And I think a lot of the output that we're seeing now is from this viewpoint, this new contemporary viewpoint, which, let's face it, was actually designed and came to be, the Wahhabi theology really came to be to fight the colonial Ottoman Empire. So first of all, and I'll say that in inverted commas because that's what they believe. So first of all, the Islam that we're seeing spreading, or the version of Islam that we're seeing spreading now, in my view, and certainly in the view of many Muslims, although growing, although decreasing, is not traditional classical Islam. So to go back to your question, I think that contemporary Islam and Islamism certainly is at odds with liberal Western values, but certainly traditional classical Islam, the Islam of my parents and my grandparents, etc., certainly isn't.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. Harris, that was wonderful information to share, and it's very important to know that someone's doing this sort of very necessary work. So thank you for joining us today, and the best wishes to you and your endeavors as you continue trying to detox these Islamists. Thank you.